This voice was when he was James McKenna.
Yeah, good morning, Your Honors. I'm James McKenna for the Lake Voice. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and may it please the Court.
But we have the last on the clock, so I'll use
it. Okay, thank you, Your Honor. In this case, the District Court erred primarily by failing to follow the secret judgment standard. Ms. Voice, as the non-moving party, should have had the benefit of the evidence being viewed in the light most favorable to herself, should have had all reasonable inferences drawn in her favor, and any credibility issues should not have been decided at all, certainly not in Wynn's favor, and Wynn's version of the events as was done here. The District Court, at least implicitly, invoked the honest belief rule or the honest belief doctrine. This Court has never squarely addressed that issue, at least under that name, but the closest it's come is in Villa-Armijo versus Lomai on air. And that case sort of talks about looking at what the employer honestly believed. And the District Court did that in this case. And that type of a view, that honest belief rule, at least the way it was used here, is inconsistent with summary judgment standard because it necessarily requires or allows the court to view the evidence and view everything in the favor of the moving party, the defendant in this case. This Court has repeatedly said that a full airing of cases, especially in discrimination cases, a full airing is necessary because they're so factually intense, and a full airing of it in front of a trier of fact is really necessary to get to the bottom of what happened in many of these cases. So the...
I'm not sure why the honest belief doctrine issue matters much here. I mean, basically, Wynn is saying he thought she was working somewhere else. We thought that she was working there against our policies and also in a way that showed that she was lying to us about her disabilities. Whether or not they had an honest belief in all those things, if they even had an honest belief in some of them, or even somewhat belief some of them, if they were firing her because of those beliefs, isn't that a sign that they weren't firing her because she was disabled?
Well, they were firing her based upon, I believe they were firing her primarily due to her workers' compensation claim. Her workers' compensation claims that she had, and it's important because...
Well, what is the evidence, really, of that when they were surveilling her? I mean, they clearly, you know, maybe they weren't 100% sure, and so they're not honest, but it's like mostly belief or something. They had some kind of an interest in her activities, and that was well established by what they had done so far. So why doesn't that have very strong, wasn't that a very strong way to show that her argument that it was because of disability is just not right?
Well, the thing about what they claim is...
Also, the retaliation for the
workers' compensation. So the main thing is that they didn't really give her a chance. This is a very flawed investigation. They didn't give her any kind of chance to explain herself at all after they already basically brought her in and told her that she was being fired.
It seems like if they think that it's because... So they didn't give her a chance to explain. So if they had given her a chance to explain, maybe she could have convinced them. But the point is, without the chance to explain, they continue to believe she's doing this work that's improper or somehow showing she's dishonest. And so why that's a reason that's not a retaliatory reason and not a discriminatory reason. It might be a wrong reason, but I don't know that there's a law conspiring her for surveillance that was deceptive.
Well, but their motives really called into question by what actually took place here. They had somebody surveilling her actually for a number of months, and it wasn't until approximately April 23rd when another manager in the food and beverage department, whose name was, Pedro Gutierrez. And we have this email, it's in Excerpt Record 3, page 340. He says that he believes that she might be working at Caesar's Palace, and she heard that, and that she might have been working full duty or not full duty. I based on that, they decided they're going to send the surveillance out again. And interestingly, that same thing.
What is the evidence that that was retaliatory or discriminatory?
Right. So what they did is that day, they contacted York, their third-party administrator for workers' compensation, who then contacted the security or the surveillance people and said, okay, let's go out and surveil her. We're giving you a $2,000 budget. And literally, like within an hour, they wrote back and said, oh, no, she didn't release her work full duty, so we don't really need to do this. And then 2 days later, on the 25th of April, they say, no, go ahead and do it. We'll only half the budget, and we need you to get her wearing her uniform. At what point she was back at working full duty and at when? So the only reason to continue to surveil her and to continue to go through this is if they were continuing on with their attempt to, you know, terminate her employment, which really goes back to April 19th when we have emails. I mean,
how would terminating her help them? So if she has an old workers' comp claim, presumably it keeps getting paid even if they terminate her. I don't quite understand the logical chain.
Right. So when she has the new workers' comp in for you on May 3rd.
But that's after, so they can't be retaliating against her because it hasn't happened yet.
Well, they had the original claim. They did it all the way back to September 2012. She had a number of claims, and I believe that with surveillance, it shows that they were mistrustful of her. They didn't like her claim, the fact that she had a number of claims. And when they go ahead and, you know, issue this order to surveil her, even though she's been working full duty while she's working at Caesars Palace, it doesn't matter. Their policy is that she can work at Caesars Palace as long as, while she's on FMLA leave, she's not exceeding the doctor's restrictions by working at another job. Other than that, it's perfectly fine for her to be working there. So they're chasing her down. They're trying to get evidence of her doing something wrong so that they can use that protection license. The very definition of a pretext. They wanted to get this reason so they could fire her. Because they didn't like her.
Once they get the reason, I mean, once they get the reason if she really is doing this, then how is it still retaliatory?
Because they're turning a blind eye to what was really going on. She wasn't working beyond her restrictions. If they'd asked her for that, if they'd asked her for the explanation, if they'd told her specifically what they wanted from Caesars Palace, she could have cleared this up for them. They weren't interested in that. What they wanted to do was to fire her. They wanted to get rid of her and her workers' compensation claims and the need to accommodate her under the ADA. All of that is something that they wanted to essentially circumvent by firing her.
I get the I understand you, yeah, how to get an argument. Because you surveyed us all, I can sort of understand that. The question is not tie it back to, and I think that maybe it was just frame of view, how do you tie it back to the retaliation for the specific protected activities? Maybe it's just a like, or maybe not legitimate reasons, but not illegal reasons might want to be altogether. Or they only didn't want to be working with another employee as well, because who knows, she might have other secrets, you know, whatever. You have to do more than sort it out together. You have to show that, your evidence that it's tied to the particular activities. How do you do that?
Well, with respect to the new, and again, I think a lot of these are very factually intensive questions.
I think we're all willing to give your clients benefit of the doubt as well. We're asking you these questions, but what can you point to at that time in the record that is believed?
Okay. Well, when she filed and gets injured again on May 3rd, and she has a new workers' compensation claim, they put her out. They don't follow their own policy. In other words, they're looking to fire her, and when this new injury happens, they don't follow their own policy. Their own policy is to give all injured employees accommodation through a temporary light-duty job assignment. They have an extensive policy that deals with that, and here they don't. They put her out involuntarily without talking to her, without having any kind of interactive process, without having any kind of individualized assessment. They just say, we're putting you out on FMLA leave. She didn't ask for it. She didn't have a medical certification for that. she did have restrictions from her doctor, but medical certification is coming to our markets on a specific form that is used for FMLA. So they just, they put
her on. Well, given her light duty before, though, it was she after she had made other workers' compensation claims, right? So doesn't that add some weight, at least, to their claim that at that point there was a light duty that they could give her? Maybe they could give it to other people who were injured or something that it was used up?
Well, so a couple of things about that. First of all, they had always provided that to her before, and now they're not going to. And, in fact, we have an email, which is part of our Americans with Disabilities Act claim, that says she can't work back here until she's released full duty. That's like a 100% healed policy that is, per se, a violation of the ADA.
But you just told us that's not their general policy, so.
Right, so they're not following their general policy. Well, their general policy, no, I'm sorry, it's two different policies. First of all, the workers' compensation light duty policy, that's one thing. But a policy that says we're not letting you come back to work here until you're 100% full duty, that is, per se, a violation of
the ADA. They have no policies of one, sorry, they can't coexist. They're in conflict with each other.
Well, they're not following the first one, it's the problem. They weren't doing that, and it ultimately, I think, ends up being because they're going to deny the claim. And in that same May 20th email from Sonny Orpheus, the workers' comp manager, he mentions to her supervisor, Ms. Herrera, that yes, we are going to be denying the claim.
So what is the evidence that your client has offered that she engaged in the interactive process about whether there was an accommodation? Like they said, we don't have light duty for you. What did she do that shows she engaged in the interactive process at that point?
Well, she had always been ready, willing, and able to work the light duty job that she had. Here, she wasn't given really the opportunity to participate in any interactive process because they put her out on leave right away.
Did she try? Did she request a meeting? Did she ask to talk to HR? Did she do anything?
I don't think there's anything on record that would establish that. Once they told her, you're out on light duty, you're out on leave, that she was out on leave. The only thing she did after that was she came back and asked to be paid for vacation pay while she was out. Beyond that, I don't think there was anything else, but again.
Now, is there, do you have a case that says that that's adequate, that her effort to engage in the interactive process was adequate?
Well, I think we cite to the EEOC compliance where it talks about what is required of an employer. And when an employer knows that an employee is unable to do their regular job, it puts the onus and the burden on the employer to engage in the interactive process. It's page 38 of our brief. Actually, it's from Barnett, the Barnett versus Hewitt Sarah case, this court's 2000 opinion, where it talks about what triggers the interactive process, and it talks about when an employer should initiate the reasonable accommodation interactive process without being asked if the employer, one, knows that the employee has a disability, and clearly they knew she had a disability, or they put her out on the unilaterally, and she definitely had, you know, an opportunity to switch. Okay, so I'll move along. So the other thing I want to say real quickly under the Americans with Disabilities Act is,
I want to say this one, but
what's that?
You were trying to say something about the other 2 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just real quickly, the district court said that forcing her on leave was a reasonable accommodation. I don't think, unless an employee asks for that leave, that's not a reasonable accommodation. They need to try and get her work, and they need to try and have her continue working. That's what the ADA is all about. Just saying, go out on leave, and that's a reasonable accommodation. It's not sufficient.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jen Serafina, representing the appellee, Wynn Las Vegas, LLC. I'm first going to address the termination decision and Ms. Moss's insufficient for delay to her discharge case, especially as it relates to the honest or reasonable belief doctrine. Then I would like to discuss the ADA disability claims that Mr. Dan Perros and also John Bridgman involved in Title VII claims. Again, of course, answering any questions that you may have for me. We've already discussed a little bit about the termination reason here, that she was terminated because she was working for another employer in the same job.
But there was not against company rules, right?
It's against the FMLA policy. You cannot be out on FMLA leave for your stated reasons. She said that I have limitations. I can't use my right arm. I can't perform the essential functions of my job.
I'm sorry. What's the answer to my question?
I'm sorry. Can you say the question again?
It was good to listen to the question.
Yes, sir.
It was not against the employer's policy to work for another employer.
You are correct. There's no general policy against having two jobs. However, WINS FMLA policy says that you cannot be out on FMLA leave to take care of whatever medical issue you have and work in a consistent job and using the same types of job duties in another job. So
what they do is they see her going into another employer's employee entrance. They don't follow her. They don't see what she's doing. They don't ask her what she's doing. How do we know, or how does the employer know that she isn't there doing the kind of life duty that WIN wasn't willing or able to give her?
Well, sure. No, actually, the investigation firm that conducted the investigation, they actually did follow her. They did follow her into the establishment and tried to see what exactly she was doing at Caesars. They weren't able to determine that.
Okay, I didn't guess how they went in, but the point is they weren't able to figure it out.
Correct.
As far as they knew, she wasn't doing anything inconsistent with her presentations about her ability to work, right?
Right, so what we have here, though, this is...
So far, they have nothing.
Well, so what we have, though, is the fact that...
That's right, isn't it?
No.
So far, they have nothing.
We have a little more than nothing because she worked as a kitchen worker at WIN, and she works as a kitchen worker at Caesars Palace.
But you said they didn't know what she was doing at WIN.
Did you know?
At Caesars.
They did.
That's what you said.
Correct. They didn't know the specific job functions she performed, let's just say May 4th, the day after her workers' compensation injury at WIN. But they did have a due process meeting with her, and they asked her.
So, you still have nothing, right? So, you still have nothing. They go in, they try to figure out, they have nothing. They have no evidence, they have zero evidence that she's doing anything that's inconsistent with her representations about her abilities.
We have zero evidence.
Until they talk to her. They have nothing, right?
Right, they have a reasonable belief that because...
They have a suspicion.
Right, they have a suspicion that because the kitchen worker position at WIN is covered by a culinary agreement, and it's the same culinary agreement that they have with Caesars. So I think it's reasonable to assume that a kitchen worker position at WIN is very similar to a kitchen worker position at Caesars.
But I don't have any evidence that she's doing kitchen worker. She could have been doing rooms. She could have been doing other things. They have no idea, they have no evidence what work she's doing for Caesars. Yes or no?
Correct. So
there are things she can do for Caesars unrelated to kitchen work that don't involve anything inconsistent with her state of abilities, right?
Correct.
So they still have nothing, right?
But this is a situation where she was a kitchen worker at WIN and she was a telephone operator.
They don't know that. They don't know that. All they know is she goes in, they can't employ his entrance, they try to find out something about what she's doing, but she could have been a telephone operator, right? Is there anything that they knew that included her being a telephone operator?
Well, not at that specific moment, but then
okay, so when I say at that point they have nothing, and you keep arguing with me, you are just wasting time.
Sorry. So at that point, they had only
nothing.
Only what the surveillance and other fields.
Right.
Right.
So let's touch on nothing and see what happens next.
Right. So then when they receive the surveillance report that says that at least she showed up for WIN in her uniform, followed her to the Rayo's kitchen, and couldn't really see what she was doing there. But then they had a meeting with her because it looked to WIN as though she was doing her kitchen worker job over at Caesars the day after she suffered a workplace injury and said she couldn't work because of her restrictions at WIN. So they met with her, they had a due process meeting. That due process meeting allows employees to tell their side of the story. She did indicate at that point, well, they were accommodating me. Okay, let's get some information on that. If they are accommodating you, if you're unlikely to be there, that's the information that we need. She never gave Wynn the names of the people who were accommodating her. So when Morris talks about the fact that Wynn didn't call over, they could have just called over to see if they didn't know who to call. Ms. Morris was in the best position to obtain that information.
They hire investigators and they can't figure out who is the supervisor for the Houston Health.
Well, actually,
I can't figure it out.
Right.
You know, I think I can figure it out. I think you can figure it out. You don't think that one casino can figure out who the supervisor is in the hotel, can't tell who to talk to at another hotel about who the supervisor is. I mean, that seems totally so silly.
Well,
it really sort of stores up the suspicion that they're not together. It just seems so petty and so unbelievable.
Well,
then one can't figure out who to call over there.
Well, first of all, ultimately, Wynn did receive information that indicated that she was working full-time over there. But until they got that information, it was difficult to know. But in the record, it shows that Ms. Morris worked in several different kitchens. She worked in Serendipity. She worked in Rayo. She worked in the buffet. She worked in the room service kitchen. So there are a variety of different places. And again, without knowing who she's talking to, it would have been very difficult for Wynn to observe. I'm not saying it's impossible. So to your point, it's not impossible. But having been the person who worked over there, just
what would it do when she comes in? She says, they're giving me accommodation. I'm working over there. They're giving me accommodation, so I'm not having to do work that I'm not able to do.
Right. And
what happens next? They say, what's time it? We just can't figure it out.
They asked her to provide information. They didn't know at the time, so then they asked Ms. Moyes to provide the information. If you're being accommodated, please provide us with that information. She had a union steward present. The union was also able to assist her in that. They tried, even after the termination through the grievance process, to assist in that. But ultimately, no information was ever provided indicating that Susan knew about the restrictions and that they were accommodating those restrictions. It was just a general list from one of the kitchens that she worked in, from a pastry chef who's not even a member of management, that just said, oh, here's a list of things. But that doesn't say, oh, yes, we knew. She told us that she had limited use of her right arm, and we were able to accommodate that, and we did so by only having her do this. So based on the information I had at the time, it would reasonably believed that Ms. Morris was working in contravention of the law, that we have employee policy saying that you cannot work for another employer using the same, doing the same job and the same functions when you are saying you need leave from us to.
And this is based on an absence of evidence, right? She says that they haven't gathered any evidence contrary to it, but she has failed to come up with evidence that does the employee have to gather evidence of a common cause?
When we look at a reasonable determination that an employer makes, it's similar to the pretext analysis. So she does need to prove pretext, and one of the ways you can prove, there's a lot of different ways you can prove pretext, and one of them is whether, for example, the company changed its decision.
The fact that they don't pick up the phone and call over and figure out the relevant person to talk to and say, hey, you've got one of our employees working there, what is she doing? How about the fact that they don't bother to do that? It's something that any sentient human being that runs a business would know how to do. I am just baffled by this claim that Wynn's hotel and casino cannot crossed the line.
Perhaps Wynn could have tried to make the telephone calls, but again, they did not have the names or the people to whom they should speak to. Ms. Moyes had that information, but she did not provide it. The other thing to just kind of keep in the back of your mind is that Caesars is a competitor of Wynn. It's not that they typically like to share information, especially when you're talking about employees. If you're concerned about Wynn, why would you
speak about Wynn? How should they be able to employ some of the competitors? They have allies. You know, the company and the union, you know, they have that point. They seem to have, you know, a
couple of them. But essentially here, when we're looking at pretext, which is Ms. Moyes' burden to establish, you look at whether or not the company had evidence and whether it acted consistently with that evidence. And here, because of the workers' compensation aspect, they did report this.
Can you address the 100% loyalty policy?
Sure. That is not the policy. There is that email from Stoney making an off-reference to coming back full duty, but as Chief Friedland pointed out, that's not the policy, and it never has been the policy. The very fact that Ms. Moyes
was... Well, this is what makes money. I'm going to give a benefit of the doubt, right?
Well, she...
We use it to use this policy, and that's all we have time for.
Right.
But why haven't they put forward enough evidence to get this out? Because we have to believe into all reasonable inference from what the plaintiff presents, right?
Right. First, this was raised at oral arguments, so it wasn't really briefed below before the district court. However,
then what is this?
The issue of 100% yield policy. That was not part of the briefing before the district court. It was raised at oral argument by Ms. Lewis. However, there still is enough evidence in the record to establish that that is not a policy. As Judge Friedland pointed out, Ms. Moyes herself had had light duty on numerous occasions, and when she was on those light duty assignments, she had a lot of restrictions, you know, pushing and pulling over 10 pounds or whatever. So because the very fact that she's received light duty, the very fact that...
Why don't they give her accommodations then, Ms.
Lewis? Okay, so this happened on a Friday. She was released from the Concentra Medical Center at 3:11 on Friday afternoon. It was so late in the day. These restrictions were different from others. It wasn't just no pushing or pulling over 5 or 10 pounds. It was, quote, limited use of right arm, unquote. That is very nebulous. How do you accommodate limited use of right arm? I mean, even polishing silverware, you're using your arm that might exacerbate the injury. So the reasonable thing to do was to put her on a leave until her follow-up appointment. Maybe she would have gotten better to the point where she would have restrictions, which we could deal with. And
how is that engaging in an interactive process? How is an unpaid leave a reasonable accommodation? That can't be right. I mean, if that were right, you could just basically fire someone by putting them on indefinite unpaid leave.
The leave is a reasonable accommodation, especially if you're dealing in situations like this, where the restrictions were so severe that an immediate life-duty position was not the right
option. But I mean, she didn't ask. So if someone asked for unpaid leave, it might be reasonable. But she's saying, I want light duty. How can they just unilaterally put her on unpaid leave at that point?
Under the ADA, an accommodation has to be reasonable and it has to be effective. And every court, including this one, has found that
paid leave would have been reasonable and effective.
Paid leave is not required under the ADA. It's just
but you see, there are no options. There are no options. Paid leave would be one of them.
Well, ultimately, because
of social services, it's not like this was the entity.
It might be different if she's contagious.
I mean, they find out, you know, whether she's got a contagious disease. They might just say, we're putting you out and we're not going to pay you. I don't know what it means. We're not just saying I'm paid leave, but you can't walk in and there's contagion to fellow workers and the public. But also says, you know, my job doesn't work. It's not just like you can do this. I could polish a lot of stuff that I left out.
As I stand here, I don't know, but,
Well, this is why we have an interactive process. We sort of ask, what can you do with enough time to say, well, you know, I understand that I can pause it or stuff.
Right.
We don't know.
The employer under the ADA and under this court's ruling in the EEOC.
I mean, why don't they ever come in and talk about it?
It was very late in the day. It was Friday afternoon. They just
called. It doesn't mean anything in Vegas, especially not in Vegas hotels. that's just what business gets by them. So, you know, Congress is trying to ask the moon. Let's see how your case.
Actually, certain departments do elect the workers' compensation. They don't just say, workers' compensation department, certain departments.
Well, so it keeps the maps up Friday afternoon.
But it's a collaborative process between the department and the workers' compensation department. Like duty, like duty is fostered through the workers' compensation division. But the employer, under the ADA, the employer gets to choose the reasonable accommodation. And it can choose the most easiest. It can choose the easiest accommodation. It can choose the least expensive accommodation as long as it's effective and true.
So you don't want an unpaid leave until Monday morning when they should have talked to HR?
Right, and then she did. There were further communications because she said, yes, okay, fine, I'm out on leave. Let me have my vacation pay, and that way I'm going to be covered through part of that. And ultimately, during that leave of absence that was granted, even though she didn't specifically request it, she had surgery on her shoulder, so she wouldn't have been able to work for a good 4 months.
Before Monday morning?
That was literal. That was, you're right, that was a few weeks later, but it was during the period of time that she was out on leave.
How much was that Monday morning? I mean, you say, okay, you know, we can't deal with it because HR is closing, but they open up again Monday morning. Say, come in Monday morning and we'll have an interactive process at that point.
Right, so Monday morning.
Using the day.
Yes, they had further communications because she had talked about getting vacation pay. They processed that paperwork so that she could get vacation pay. That necessarily was a communication that happened that was part of the interactive process.
So is your argument basically that she had to suggest what she could do with her left arm rather than you saying, what can you do with your left arm? I mean, it doesn't seem like there was any time when the employer said, what could you do?
Well, it is a joint obligation. The company knows what types of jobs it has available. They are not obligated under the ADA to create a new position for a light duty or for anybody just because of the ADA. So, but obviously, the employee is in a better situation to know what her limitations are. Through that and her doctor, that's when you come together and try to figure it out.
Did they have us on Monday morning to say, well, close, say, hey, we have these other jobs available. We'll come in and talk about what jobs are available.
No, at that point, she's still under her restrictions of limited use of the right arm. So,
but the whole point is that she wants to be able to do things without the right arm. Did they say, well, we couldn't deal with this Friday night, so we'll put you on paid leave, but HR is opening up again Monday morning. Let's talk about all these other jobs we have. Did they do that?
They had a discussion on Monday. The discussion, the result of that discussion was just that.
Just a yes or no answer. Did they have a discussion when they said, come in, or let's talk over the phone about what jobs you can do?
I do not believe they discussed other jobs because the restrictions of limited use of right arms was still in place at that time, which would have made it very, very difficult for them to find anything.
But they didn't try. They did nothing. I mean, the excuse that this is Friday night, it's too late. We'll give you Friday night and we'll give you the weekend. If Monday morning they don't try and say, hey, let's see if there are things you can do. Yes or no? As far as I'm concerned.
I do not believe that they had further discussions about other jobs. There's no other record that she was out on leave and then
there was an offer. They didn't say, hey, we have some other jobs available. Come in and see what you can do. Why don't they have a duty to do that? Why isn't that part of the responsibility?
Because the employer gets to choose the accommodation, and at this point, a leave of absence is a reasonable accommodation because
unpaid leave of absence is a reasonable accommodation.
It is. Every court in this country, including this court, has held that leave of absence can be a reasonable accommodation, especially
is there a case that says that in a situation where the employee did not ask for it.
It's the employer's choice to choose what.
Well, if he says that, then it's a reasonable accommodation when an employee, even when it's not requested. Maybe there's one, but
I believe it's EEOC versus UPS Supply Chain Solutions.
That's our case. You think
yes.
That said that?
Well, I know that it says that leave and other types of accommodations are reasonable accommodations.
Actually, EEOC versus Congress,
yeah. UPS Supply Chain Solutions.
Thank you.
selecting a reasonable accommodation.
I'm sorry, CPS versus?
Supply Chain Solutions.
Who's that, EEOC?
EEOC versus UPS Supply Chain Solutions. And the employer has the ultimate decision in selecting a reasonable accommodation. It doesn't have to be the best accommodation, and the employer may choose the easier accommodation.
It doesn't say anything about unpaid leave. I mean, that may be assuming that the accommodation will cause some kind of working.
But unpaid leave is, even the United States Supreme Court has held that up to a year of unpaid leave is a reasonable accommodation.
But when requested?
Well, you don't have to select the accommodation that the employee
needs. There's an interactive process, so if the employee is saying, look, I really can't do anything, I'm just on surgery, I can't come back for a year, please keep my job open, then maybe it's reasonable to say, okay. But if the employee is saying, I want to work, the employer can just get rid of them by saying, okay, if we're putting you on unpaid leave, that's cheaper. I mean, that would defeat the whole idea. If employers can always do the cheapest thing, that's totally not right.
Under the ADA, an employer is not obligated to create a job. So if there is not light duty work available.
We don't know. They don't call her and say, we've looked, and here's what's available. They don't say there's no other light work available. Nothing. They just say, you're on unpaid leave.
Well,
you're on unpaid leave.
Right. You're out on unpaid leave until the workers' compensation framework covers that, or she ended up asking for her vacation pay to cover part of that, and then she was out for her surgery anyway.
If you can't cite a case like this one where the employer shows unpaid leave against the employee's will.
But most leave is unpaid leave, especially if you're talking about any length of time.
I keep saying potato and you keep saying potato. Why should I ask my question and then you can tell me more? Can you point to a case where the employer shows unpaid leave rather than any other accommodation that the employee had to take it?
Not off the top of my head. I can't. I'm sorry.
Okay. Why don't you take the next 24 hours and see if you can come up with a case?
Okay.
Okay, and if so, file a 28-J letter. So I'm going to pose a counsel.
Thank you.
It's not. So it's not really saying you couldn't.
I will do that, sir.
Would you mind if I asked a brief question about hostile work environment?
Sure.
Because the district court indicated that Moise didn't identify any supervisor by name who engaged in the harassment. In her deposition, she identifies Rosa. This is ER Volume 2, 12, 14. Is this Rosa Martinez, who's identified on page 213 as the manager? And who are Belinda and Victor? Are these supervisors or managers? Because she identifies them in her deposition.
They are supervisors.
So, in other words, the district court was incorrect in saying that she does not identify any supervisor by name who was present or engaged in the harassment or knew of the harassment.
Well, so she generally says that management knew about this. But the thing is, there's not any other level of specificity as to what those supervisors allegedly said. There's a variety of comments that she claims that were made, including things like that woman in Spanish, that's a mujer, that woman, or mala, meaning bad. That doesn't necessarily connotate any kind of national origin. It's just like a general discussion about who she is, or kind of one kind way of pointing her out as to somebody else. But that is a rise to actionable harassment under Title VII. It's not sufficient. It's not even tied to any kind of class. So the problem is we don't know, even if one of those managers said something like that, we don't know if it was something like that or something more severe that might be actionable.
So the district court does identify, at least in general terms, that there was language and conduct that essentially could be hostile, but that the record lacks any identification by her of any supervisors or managers involved when she's describing the activities of Rosa Martinez and Belinda and Victor.
again, here, with regard to that, there may be vicarious liability if that results in an intangible employment action. And that, any of those comments, even if they were said, has nothing to do with the ultimate termination reason, which was regarding her working for another company while she was receiving workers' compensation.
But that should be a separate standalone claim within the confines of her complaint.
Well, but it had nothing to do with it. There's no causal connection.
Hostile environment is not a standalone claim of denial of equal opportunity.
Well, yes, it would be, but it has to result in an intangible employment. That's the claim.
And hostile environment is not in and of itself an adverse circumstance that is actionable.
Well, it might be, but an employer is only vicariously liable if it results in a tangible employment action. An employer is only vicariously liable for the hostile work environment if it results in a tangible employment action. And so here, there's no causal connection between any alleged harassment and her termination reason.
So you don't keep somebody employed and just make miserable the circumstances on the basis of she's doing this, she is this, she's that. But as long as you don't fire her, she doesn't have any claim or protection under Title VII.
No, because again, here, one of the main problems with Ms. Moise's case is she never complained to employee relations, which was unreasonable in this case because she went to employee relations on two other occasions to complain about minor workplace incidents. She's a lead at that when she had a subordinate that was taking her breaks at the least most inopportune times, and that was upsetting to Ms. Moise. She went to employee relations. Employee relations met with her. They met with the other employee. They told the other employee, look, Elena Moise is your lead. You have to follow her direction. You can't just take break. That was resolved to her satisfaction.
So she says she tried to file a complaint this time, and she really got the runaround, and you say, or the district court says, that under your policy she could have complained to the vice president of human resources or the legal department or her division vice president or other member of management she felt comfortable with. Are you aware of any other employees who work in Wings Kitchens who previously complained to the vice president of HR or the legal department?
Not that I can think of. I think I would be outside the record in this case anyway, but not that I can think of off the top of my head. But my point is, she has gone to employee relations and had other complaints that were completely unrelated to the allegations contained in her complaint and had those resolved to her satisfaction. So it's completely unreasonable for her not to have gone back to employee relations, especially when she admitted in her deposition that the employee relations counsel was very helpful and very fair. And so it's unreasonable for her not to do that. And I might point out the other two times that she went to employee relations, she submitted something in writing. You don't have to meet with somebody right away. You submit it in writing, and then they read it, and they set up an appointment with you. They meet with you. They talk to the other people that you have to that they have to interview to get to the bottom of this. And that's exactly what happened on the other two times. So if she felt like she was getting the runaround, she just had to submit another complaint in writing, and it would have been addressed. Thank you.
With respect to the workers' compensation liability policies at ER Volume 2, pages 65 to 69, if you review that, it's very clear they give practically everybody light-duty work. They don't want lost time claims in the workers' comp, and that's why they have this very detailed policy that they provide to people. They didn't do it in this case. And in fact, on ER Volume 2, page 71, is the Stony Worth email from Monday, May 20th, which says, please note that she cannot return to work until she is released to full duty. And that is saying, at least with respect to Elena Moise, that policy says she has to be 100% healed. It didn't take into account this hotel has thousands of employees, thousands of jobs, and what he's saying is she can't come back to work until she's full duty, even if we have something else. You know, they have lots of different jobs that she might be able to do, and they never had the interactive process with her. The other thing I wanted to mention briefly was she was not asked about how Caesars Palace was accommodating her or asked to provide anything in the lab. She was actually fired. And later she got that through the union, the district court. Said, well, it's not on Caesar's Palace letter end. Again, that is just not viewing the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Moises. Your Honor, that's what's going on here, and that's what I think.